The first reading this morning comes from Bereshit, as it's called in Hebrew, or the book of Genesis, as the Greek translation is known in English. It was put down in writing from earlier oral legends around the year 500 before the beginning of our era. Now, many of us in this room have heard this story before, but not with this translation. Please do what you can to hear this legend, and yes, satire, as if for the very first time. This is from the Yahwist strand, as scholars call it, meaning it's a strand of writing that uses the word Yahweh instead of Elohim as the name of divinity, of God. It's much earlier in origin than the equally famous In the Beginning.
Now the dragon was the most wily creature which Yahweh had made. The dragon spoke to the woman, "Do I understand that you've been warned about eating fruit from any of the fruit trees in the orchard?" "Oh, not at all," said the woman. "We're welcome to eat anything we want, except we're supposed to leave the tree in the middle of the orchard alone. We've been warned clearly by God, don't eat from it, don't even touch it, or you'll drop dead." The dragon responded, "Oh, nonsense. You won't die. God knows that the moment you eat of that tree, you'll see things as they really are. In fact, you'll be just like God, knowing everything, ranging from good to evil, pleasure to pain." The woman did indeed notice that the tree looked like good eating and realized what she would get out of it. She'd know everything. So she took some of the fruits, and gave them to her companion, and they ate. Immediately they saw things as they really are, and could see that they weren't wearing any clothes. So they twisted some fig leaves into some makeshift clothes to hide their nakedness.
The second reading is a very beautiful and quite striking poem by Ellen Bass of Santa Cruz, California. This was written in 2007. I found this poem last week when I was at the Senior Ministers of Large Church Conference out in Santa Barbara, and immediately decided that no matter what I was preaching about this morning, I was going to use this.
What if you knew you'd be the last to touch someone? If you were taking tickets, for example, at the theater, tearing them, giving back the ragged stubs, you might take care to touch that palm, brush your fingertips along the lifeline's crease. When a man pulls his wheeled suitcase too slowly through the airport, when the car in front of me doesn't signal, when the clerk at the pharmacy won't say thank you, I don't remember they're going to die. A friend told me she'd been with her aunt. They'd just had lunch, and the waiter, a young gay man with plum black eyes, joked as he served the coffee, kissed her aunt's powdered cheek when they left. Then they walked half a block, and her aunt dropped dead on the sidewalk. How close does the dragon's spume have to come? How wide does the crack in heaven have to split? What would people look like if we could see them as they are, soaked in honey, stung and swollen, reckless, pinned against time?
Thank you.
I've quoted psychologist David Richo's definition of a spiritual life many times in this pulpit, and I'm going to begin this sermon by quoting it again. Whatever we do to shed our illusions, that's our spiritual life. We can do this in many ways, by meditating, by reflecting thoughtfully on our own life stories, by practicing a spiritual discipline of some sort, yoga perhaps, or contemplative prayer. Therapy and conversation can help too. But whatever it is that helps us to shed our illusions, that's the trick. Back in 2005, my best friend Richard and I were shedding some illusions via a very moving conversation that we had over the phone. We were reflecting on our lives between the years 1985 and 1995, several lifetimes ago. It was the AIDS decade in California. He had buried dozens of friends, and I did so many funerals for folks that I loved that I almost lost count. John Zimorowski, amen. Alex Stevens, amen. Mark DeWolf, amen. Frank Siskowski, amen. John Sykes, amen. And most central to my soul, Stefan Missler, amen. And Yit Gadol V'Yit Kadosh. I could go on for an hour more with this litany easily. So Richard and I were talking, and he says to me, "You know, I'm starting to feel different these days." And I asked, "What do you mean?" And he said, "In the decade between 1985 and 1995, the year that Stefan died, it always felt to me like you and I were in deep trenches, like the ones they had in World War I. Death all around us, fire and smoke everywhere. We were scared all the time, burying everyone that we loved, and yet fighting to survive day after day after day. Suddenly, when the meds were developed in 1995, the death rate dropped drastically. Since then, have you noticed? The sky has been clearing. The birds are starting to chirp. And just today, I thought of myself as poking my head above the edge of the trench and to check things out because it finally seems safer. And you know what? The whole time you and I were down there in those trenches, millions of other people had been shopping at Macy's, cutting their lawns, and going on vacations that we didn't notice. We only saw hospitals and and funeral homes, the trenches." I was moved by what he said and realized that it was true for me. It was an apt, accurate, if dramatic, metaphor. But the conversation did help me to realize that I had been living in a hole of grief for over a decade, a low-grade but very real depression, siphoning off my energy from every action. And I have to admit, part of my grief was increased by resentment. Our friends were all under 40, that is, young. And annoying television pastors were shouting, "And good riddance to you too, you hellbound sinners," the whole time that we were weeping. And so my resentment was colored with rage. But I finally left that life to come here in 1998. And I've been reflecting on my former life with Richard these last couple of years. I've come to realize that all those years I had let resentment compound my grief. I had forgotten my spiritual roots and taken on a terrible illusion which I now had to shed. You see, I had unconsciously bought into the theories of St. Augustine, an ancient theologian, and rejected the wisdom of the heretic Pelagius, by whose name we Unitarians and Universalists were damned for years by our critics. You fool Pelagians, you. The children's story this morning offered you a simple version of the theories of Augustine and Pelagius. Let me give you a more thorough version of what Augustine said. When the earth began, he said, it was perfect. No volcanoes, no earthquakes, no meteorites to wipe out dinosaurs, no tornadoes wiping out Kentucky towns off the map, no viruses killing off our friends, no headaches, no mosquitoes, no scorpions, vipers, poison ivy, or thorns on roses. No death either. Immortality was everywhere. Then the so-called first people ate from a tree they were told not to eat from, and everything in the entire universe cracked at that moment. Earthquake faults began to snake through the earth. Scorpions and mosquitoes started to sting. Viruses spread like pollen, killing off whole populations. And volcanoes erupted and buried cities and all the innocent children in those cities under fiery ash. And all human beings from birth were permanently bent toward cruelty, violence, murder, lies, bigotry, deception, and arrogance forever and ever. Amen. And worst of all, immortality completely disappeared. All life was now mortal and had an end. The perfect world was now permanently cracked. And Augustine preached this theory everywhere he went, and he called his teaching original sin. Pelagius, an Irish monk, came to visit Rome at the time of Augustine, around the year 405, if you'd like a date. Pelagius was completely horrified to hear this doctrine being bandied about. Sure, he agreed, human beings can be cruel, they can be violent, and they certainly can be uncivil. History offers us plenty of examples. But, he said, this has nothing at all to do with the fable of the first two people eating a fig in an ancient orchard. Death and pain and scorpions and tornadoes have always been part of the universe from the very beginning. The world is not broken. It is what it is. And furthermore, I myself am responsible for my own life, not people who lived long ago in an orchard. I am free to choose to cultivate my life so that I live it in the spirit of love and kindness, not cruelty and incivility. I don't have to lie. I don't have to destroy. I can actually tell the truth whenever I want, and I can build things up, not tear them down. And if I have been hurt or crippled by some terrible shame, my grace is to work through such unfortunate circumstances and step by step live a better, kinder life, even if I end up limping for the rest of my days. My calling as a human being is to not live a politic life bent on currying favor, but a life of integrity, the whole time imagining a world to come where no one is going to be favored or belittled or ridiculed or murdered or overpowered or lied to, where no one is railroaded into believing they belong to an inferior class or a gender or a group or a culture. Augustine wasn't going to hear any of this. The world was cracked by God, and he was going to defend his theory with a passion. He and another man who was eventually sainted, Jerome, did everything they could to make Pelagius' life miserable for teaching that human beings bear the responsibility of freedom and are not damned by the very fact of their birth. Death and disease were not natural, they said, but punishments for sin, which was not only some act of rotten behavior, but something that polluted everyone when they simply slipped through the birth canal. Pelagius, sadly, lost the argument to the great saints and was pushed out of the church. His writings were burnt, his reputation besmirched, his name had become a curse word. But you know what? He was right. Augustine and Jerome saw the world through their own cracked glasses, and they insisted that what they saw through those glasses was reality. But they were wrong. And their twisted vision has distorted Western civilization for 1,600 years. I fell for their illusion. I fell for their distortion. I was stewing in resentment that I was part of a group who experienced more death than many other groups around me, forgetting entirely that in many parts of the world back then, Bangladesh, for example, and parts of Africa, people experienced far more death and loss than I ever had on a daily basis. I was angry that people were saying that sin killed my friends and that they brought it on themselves for not rejecting their natural birth in order to be born again in a supernatural world. And that anger stunted my growth as a spiritual person. In short, although I did accept with Pelagius that all human beings are mortal, I felt that at the very least, I should be entitled to experience my grief spread out more fairly. I felt entitled to not ever have to deal with cruel and ignorant preachers or politicos or pundits gathered around me, facing me whenever I turned a corner. I felt that my loss was bad enough and that I should not have to also fight for what is right. I should be granted fairness at every turn, because after all, I'm a nice guy. I fell for an illusion. I was feeling sorry for myself. I was overwhelmed with grief, yes, but then I overwhelmed myself even more with expectations that I had an excuse in that grief to bow out of the fight for good and simply stew in resentment and anger. Sure, when you grieve, you do lose energy. Believe me, I know that very well, at least as well as anyone else in this room. But from that authentically depressive grief, I allowed myself to fall down even further, and I lost myself for a while. I forgot the healing and saving power and the religious heritage I myself claim. I forgot that all of us are worthy from birth, and there is power in that affirmation. I gave away my resentment and anger to those who find their power in ignorance, ideology, and cruelty, and guess what? It did nothing to lessen their power. It only robbed me of my own power. The composers of the Yahwist tale in Genesis were reflecting on the exact same issue. They had been in exile in the great city of Babylon for generations. There, on many public buildings, they saw the image of the dragon, like the one you see on the front cover of your order of celebration. Now, they knew of snakes that slithered without legs on the ground, but they were amazed by this image of a serpent with legs, which was favored by their overlords, the ones who kept them as servants and slaves. That image was everywhere. They associated that image with the overlord's power, the power they had to keep them as exiles, to make them work on projects not their own for almost no wages, to give birth to children that were born without dignity, in servitude. They were forced migrant workers in a foreign land, and they had their culture yanked from them every day. Many of their friends and family had died during the massacre that brought them to Babylon in the first place as grieving survivors. And they were filled with anger too, and they were totally resentful. One of them wrote very plainly of what it was like to feel that anger and that resentment. This is part of Psalm 137. Along the rivers of Babylon, we sat and we wept and we wept and we wept. Our captors mocked us sarcastically, saying, "Why don't you sing us one of your famous happy songs?" But how could we sing God's song in this foreign land? Oh, if we could only get back at you for all that you've done to us. Ah, yes, a reward to anyone who grabs one of your own babies and cracks their heads against the rocks. Instead, the authors of Genesis shed the illusion that gained steam from their anger and their resentment and told a story about walking away from it all, walking away from the orchards they had to tend for other people, walking away from painfully giving birth to their children in a foreign land, walking away from the dragon and leaving their resentments and rage for the reality of a more random world outside of that controlling empire, which claimed for itself all the fruitful gifts of life and death. It would be hard working outside the orchard without any organization provided for them, childbirth difficult without the barest medical care. But the dragon, symbol of uncivil power and the cruelty of empire, would also lose its power over them, leaving the tree of life and its false promises and being forced to crawl without legs on the ground, where, as the text later says, you can step on it and kill it before it poisons you. And eventually, they leave Babylon, and they set their process of leaving down in the satirical story of the orchard east of Eden. Sadly, many of St. Augustine's spiritual children, including Luther and Calvin, supposedly reformers, interpreted this story for generations to make it the story of death, not life, of sin, not freedom, of blame, not responsibility, and to set up the right of men to overpower women at every turn. No, Pelagius was right. Death and suffering are part of reality, and they are not distributed fairly by any human judgment, that is, and yet reality is not in and of itself broken. Reality is what it is, not what we wish it was. Viruses do not single out people, and when people are cruel to others, the perpetrators are responsible for their own behavior, and the victims do not deserve in any way what they get. When Mr. Limbaugh this week continued his attack against women who think for themselves, something he began with remarkable hurtfulness back in 1992 when he began his consistent usage of Tom Hazlitt's term feminazi, he is responsible for his own incivility and, parenthetically and for the record, anyone who uses the word Nazi to apply to anyone who is not a member of the historical Nazi Party of the early to mid-20th century has already invalidated any argument they are trying to make. Amen. Mr. Limbaugh is not the inventor of incivility against women. 100 years before the Genesis account was put to paper, a Greek named Archilochus was saying the exact same thing about a certain woman as Mr. Limbaugh did against Sandra Fluke. And although he had neither radio nor sponsors, his incivility is still remembered. Another Greek named Demonax, about 100 years later, was so uncivil in his ridicule of two people he hated that reportedly they actually committed suicide, going a long way to prove that words can actually have as much power as the famous sticks and stones. But of course, we already know that, right? All you have to do is to go visit the graves of those who have been bullied in recent years and then took their own lives in response to their loss of standing in their community, conveniently arranged by the bully. It is St. Augustine's theory, not the world, which has cracks in it. And to crack it apart till it no longer distorts and affects Western civilization, we have to turn in our resentment and our rage and exchange them for organized care and compassion. Death and illness are natural in the flow of life. And so to put cracks in St. Augustine's theory that they are unnatural, medical research and good hospices need to be supported well. Medical nursing and pastoral care practitioners need to be trained well and holistically. Healthcare needs to be made available to all, not just those who can afford it. Money needs to be spent. Tornadoes and other calamities are natural, too. They are not the result of sin or lack of proper prayer, as the self-anointed Augustinian Pat Robertson insists. So disaster preparation and funds raised through common taxation to help folks restore their destroyed lives are absolutely essential. Sponsors do have to withdraw from supporting folks like Rush Limbaugh. And I can go on again, like I did with my litany, for an hour. But now to balance things out, how about if I conclude my sermon by giving you an actual example of how a truly civil person behaves? Limbaugh and Demonax and Antilochus are bad examples. It's my job to give you a good one. I was talking to Tim Ahrens earlier this week, pastor of the First Congregational Church downtown, and he told me of a documented story of the famous Washington Gladden, minister at that church for 30 years around the turn of the last century. It seems a man named Joseph Jeffries was a member of his church. He was a wealthy member who had made his fortune in the coal mine industry, one of the 1%, we would say today. The United Mine Workers of America was formed here in Columbus in 1890. I didn't know that. And early in the last century, they threatened to strike for a living wage, better health care, and so forth, mining being a very dangerous kind of work. Mr. Jeffrey was angry and resentful about the strike, and he promised to fight it in every possible way. Washington Gladden, his minister, had a penchant for giving social sermons, and he intended to support the strike at one of his evening sermons. So he walked down to Mr. Jeffrey's mansion and asked himself in for tea. He told Mr. Jeffries what he was going to do, that he was going to support the strikers and support all of their demands, which he deemed fair. He gave reasons why he was going to do this, based on the common good. He said he was actually going to use Mr. Jeffries' name in the sermon, but that it was only fair that he should come by to let him know that, so if he chose not to come to the service, it would be okay. Mr. Jeffrey was not happy about what he was hearing, understandably. But there was no fighting. There was no name-calling. There was no ridicule. There was no outrage. It was all civil. Mr. Jeffrey, indeed, did not go to church that evening. But on Tuesday, Mr. Jeffrey accepted the demands of the union and settled on everything exactly as they wanted. He and Gladden grew closer, and in 1929, before the famous Depression, Mr. Jeffrey gave $250,000 to help build the building that now stands there on Broad. This is what civility does in the world. This is what honesty does in the world. This story alone puts a crack in St. Augustine's basic theory that we are all worthless from birth and can do nothing to improve the world ourselves. We are all mortal, naturally. We are all human. We're not sheep and goats. We're not angels and devils. We're all human, Rush Limbaugh included. All wounded, all graced, all aware of the dragon that promises us illusions. But how easy it was, I found out, to fall for them. The poet Ellen Bass must have been reflecting on something in her life the way Richard and I were doing. She wrote a poem about sudden death and mortality, but she ends it with this stunning verse, which invites us to shed every single illusion and to move toward a more honest, compassionate, deeper life, not centered on ourselves, but on our fellow humans, our neighbors. Like the Genesis storyteller, she too uses the dragon as a symbol of the illusions we'd best flee. How close does the dragon's spume have to come? How wide does the crack in heaven have to split? What would people look like if we could see them as they are, soaked in honey, stung and swollen, reckless, pinned against time?